Is it possible that I can get a couple hours in the bedroom this afternoon? No, it can't be night because I have an appointment at 8 o'clock. That's an hour drive away from here. What time is it right now? 4:30. Is it possible that like around 5:30 or so? Okay, that would be great. Yeah, put me on for 5:30. My first working experience in video was when I did 200 motels. I mean, it took me about 15 seconds to figure out what was going on, and the next thing I knew, I was doing the edits. I don't get scared, but I do get concerned because I don't like violence and I don't like to see people getting hurt, and I certainly don't want to see any of the guys in the band get hurt. Oftentimes I'll stop a show if I see something violent happening in the audience, and well, sometimes fights break out and you just stop the music and, you know, say stop it. Don't do that, because we go out there to entertain people, not to watch them get mangled.
Hanna-Barbera uses the half-hour exposure.
It's down in this dev room, which is on the ground floor, just as you walk in the door at Compact. And somebody said, hey, did you know that you could actually edit in here? And since bump-up time was pretty cheap, I said, hey, why don't I just shoot a television special tonight? So I called up Thomas Nordic, who works for me and is a video fanatic. And he brought his little Hitachi camera over, and we plugged it right in and started interviewing anybody who walked through the door, and we spent 13 hours in the dub room that night.
My name is Craig Letta. I'm a maintenance engineer here, and I just made all of this work.
Well, what did,
so
you,
to speak.
I mean, what did you do?
Specifically?
Yeah.
Hooked up two microphones, a camera, which is... should not work in this at all, but it does. And what's about
it? Was use continuity of people from the facility, intercut with these tapes that I was bumping up of various musical things. And the original dub room special was totally crude. There was no dissolves in it. It was just like punch-in edits and stuff. And a few days after that, I did an interview with these guys from San Francisco from a show called PM Magazine, and they were asking what I was doing, and I told them about this thing, and they were excited about it. So I said, well, I'll make you a deal. You give me a copy of the footage you're taking of me, and I'll give you parts of the dub room special, and you go edit yours, and I'll go edit mine. So we did, and after I got a hold of their footage, I figured, well, if I spend a little bit more money and take advantage of this continuity, I can make something more interesting out of it, and that's what I did. I went into post-production on it, and the total editing bill was $25,000.
Yes. For those of you who don't know, this is a PZM microphone, which is a really nice device, and it's one of the reasons why we're able to have a stereo dialogue track on this very cheaply produced show. This was hooked up so that Thomas Nordic, the guy who was holding the camera, could actually wear it on his head like this, so he could get very good stereo sound when he was taking these kind of pictures. Now, on a show like this, with these kind of production values, it's so important to have everything looking good and sounding good. That's why we have spared no expense, including $90 an hour, to make this television special, to bring you the real world of compact video. This is the best of the San Fernando Valley.
An unbelievable collection of films now, including stuff from the Garrick Theater, several European documentaries, including one about 200 motels that was shot on the set at the same time as we were doing the film, and some documentaries about the band with Flo and Eddie, and two features that I started but never finished, one of them that was started before 200 Motels.
So that's Uncle Me.
That's right.
And the other one is?
And the other one is something that was started as a musical project based on the performance at the Roxy, which turned into the Roxy and Elsewhere album. That whole set of concerts there was all filmed along with recording sessions at Ike Turner's studio with the Ikettes singing background on some of the tunes that we're doing, like Cheapness and that kind of stuff. Well, since I'm self-financed, it's kind of on a hobby basis. If I can make enough money out of the Bevrim special from touring it around video clubs, then I'll have enough money to reinvest and do another project. Places where you couldn't afford to send a band. They can play in smaller towns and can provide a special kind of entertainment in a lot of places where they wouldn't get a chance to see this sort of thing. And I gotta answer the door.
You mentioned at the Ritz that the soundtrack on video will always be superior to a film soundtrack. Why is that?
Because the bandwidth of optical track versus the bandwidth of the magnetic track, and also the dynamic range. There's a big difference between the two of them. And optical soundtracks are very dependent on how things are going at the lab today. You send your optical in there to be developed. If it's not developed properly, then there are going to be little focus things or little texture things in there that affect the way the audio is going to come out. It's not that critical for dialogue, but if you're talking about musical material, it's going to suffer a lot, even if you're using Dolby Sound. And with the video cassette that we played, that was just coming off the 3/4-inch cassette last night. The sound that you can get on there is as good as a record. Better, because there's no surface noise. The dynamic range is just about the same as what you get off of a master audio tape, which is better than a record. And the frequency response on the Dubrum special is probably 20 cycles up to about 18,000 cycles, as observed on the Ivy audio spectrum analyzer. It It's all on there. There's a lot of bottom and a lot of top, a lot of stuff in the middle too. And I don't think you're ever going to get that kind of an effect out of a soundtrack on a film. So I think if you're working in a medium where you're doing musical entertainment, it's probably better to live with the picture degradation that occurs on a big screen and go for the better sound rather than the other way around. I don't know how a person jumps over a fence with two rolls of film under his arm, but this guy did it. Unfortunately, I happened to be sitting in my basement with a broken leg, a cast sticking out like this, so I was not too mobile to dismiss him, but I looked at the footage, which didn't resemble the stuff that you saw in the Deplum special. It was very gory. His early stuff was extremely bloody, and he was a very weird-looking person. And so after I saw this stuff, I said, well, this is very nice, and what do you want? And he said that he had come to Los Angeles to try and find some work, and that nobody wanted to do anything with him. And I didn't have any visual projects going at that time, so I said I didn't know what to do either, and I thanked him, and he left. And I didn't have an address on him or anything, except that I knew he came from Seattle, Washington. So I guess it was about a year later we started doing the work on that 1974 television show. I said, maybe we should try and get some animation in that. So I got in touch with him and I brought him to Los Angeles. And he worked for me for a period of 8 years. I shot three frames fast in a row after he'd done one move, and I told him that that would change the pacing a little bit. And that's when he uttered the now famous line.
It's going to change the pacing of it a little bit to do that.
Hanna-Barbera uses the half-hour exposure.
It seems that about 2 weeks ago, Joe Barbera was at my house, and I had the opportunity to show that segment to him, and the response was,
When you were a kid, were you interested in animation as such?
You bet. When I was about 10 years old, I used to draw pictures all the time, and I even sent a job application to Walt Disney. And I got this letter back on Snow White stationery, which is very technicolor looking, that advised me that if I wanted to be in the animation field, the first thing I should do is go out and see this book called The Art of Walt Disney, which was obviously more expensive than anything I'd ever heard of at that time. You know, the book, it's about like that, big coffee table edition. And I went to the library and found a copy. In fact, they wouldn't even let me check it out because it was so deluxe. But I looked at it there and had all this geometry stuff in it about how they simulated the pan down a pillar in Fantasia. I don't know whether you've ever seen the book, but I looked at that and realized how little skill I had in geometry and algebra and all that kind of crap. And I said, that's not for me.
At Lincoln Center, this coming January, your orchestra music is going to be presented.
I've been trying for a long time to get this music played. And this week, while I was in town for the Dubroom special, we had a meeting with Christopher Keene, who conducts the New York opera. We've been on the verge of recording and performing this music in Poland for several years because the manager's been over there twice and negotiating with the Krakow Orchestra and this orchestra and that orchestra. And we've auditioned several orchestras for the job of recording this stuff, because it's a big project, requires a lot of rehearsal, and which means that an orchestra has to have the time to devote to it, and they have to be available at a price that's within the budget that I've got to spend to make the record. So we had already been to Mexico City prior to coming here. We tried an orchestra there. Last year we tried the Buffalo Orchestra. And So then we had this meeting with Keen, and he said that he felt that either the Long Island Symphony or the Syracuse Orchestra would be capable of doing this project, and they would be interested in doing the project. And so we looked into it, and we booked the date. So at long last, we're going to get a real performance in front of real live people with a real live orchestra of stuff that has been sitting around for years waiting for a performance.
But the robots think it's great. I do see what's easy, easy, easy.
Your Halloween show here in New York over the past few years is going to be somewhat of a tradition. Why not this year?
That's easy to answer, because last year when we worked there, we got ripped off by the Stagehands Union, and I refused to go back to the Palladium until the Stagehands Union decides that they're going to do business in an honest way. For years, we were kind of the mainstay of their business there, because we would come in and play like 6 shows, 7 shows, and they would make plenty of money for being stagehands. But last year, when we did this MTV simulcast, the ripoff went like this. They charged $6,000 to MTV for stagehand bills. For what? I don't know.
For one show.
For the Halloween night show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then they charged $6,000 to Starfleet Radio for stagehand bills. I don't know. What do they do? Lift twice as many things? Then they charged me $6,000 because I had my recording truck there. They gave me back $2,000. In the case of what happened at the Palladium, most of the moving of the equipment and stuff was being done by a crew that I brought in that I already had to pay for. Not only did I have to pay their salaries, I had to pay their housing and their food and their transportation, you know, so I've already paid. And it's preposterous to have to do business that way. I mean, when unions keep raising their prices like that, in terms of what happens in entertainment industries, like right now, stagehands make more money than classical musicians in New York. And they have benefits that go beyond what a musician will get for playing a concert. A guy can study for 20, 30 years on his instrument to get to be a classical musician, and he makes less money than the guy who cares not and pushes a chair around. Okay? Now, I don't know whether this is because the musicians don't have as strong a union as the guys who push the chair around, but it's not fair. And I think that people should be aware of that, and they should fight it. It's just not fair. Some places in Europe it's much worse, not from the union standpoint, but from the kind of halls you have to work in. And we have definitely seen them all. The place we worked in Rome, there was about 125,000 people at this concert. There was one door. This is an outdoor concert. There was one door for the band and one door for the audience. That was it. You were trapped in there. There were no toilets. There was no running water. For the crew, which is about 25 or 30 guys, to clean up after setting up this equipment in the middle of this place, which was an old slaughterhouse yard, they had like 5-gallon cans of water for them to wash their hands. You know, one guy would hold the can. It was like going back to the Stone Age.
the robots think it's great.
Wait a minute. I'm now going to... What, this?
Yes.
I invented it.
Of course.
Works like a motherfucker, too. You kidding me? Listen to the fidelity of your voice, the way you just speak into it softly. You know, it's picking you up. It's getting your aura.
Hello in there. Hello.
Hello there. I have the Wayne State University widget guide for Radio TV Quarterly, Fall of 1967. And golly, it's a thrilling little book. It's one of your better Detroit publications. And I was going to read some of it to you. I'm going to read you the best parts of it because I don't want to waste your time. On the inside of page, well, it's actually the inside back cover, but it might as well be page 65 of this thrilling booklet, we have a chart, which is headed up by a little caption. Many charts have captions here in Detroit. This one says, "Radio is the most visual medium." Now, we know that's a lie, but that's what they have on the chart. That's what you call your packaging myth. Now this here chart says at the top, WHPR 88.1, WSHJ 88.3, CKWW 88.7, WAOK, sounds like a country and western station, 89.3, WDTR 90.9, WPHS 91.5, WOUM 91, WUOM, WOUM would sound like some sort of part of your body, wouldn't it? Ha ha ha. Even here in Detroit they have those things. That's 91.7. And the chart goes on all the way down to 107.5. Now this would indicate that these are probably places on your dial where you might tune in to get information. And I would imagine that the bulk of this book concerns itself with what you'd call your radio entertainment on an FM level. Here are some of the things that they got to offer you. For instance, Wednesday, November 1st. I bet you can hardly wait for that. 6:30 p.m. They have a dynamite show called About Science. And then at 7 o'clock, they have a show called The City. At 7:30 p.m., they have The Guest Lecture. Can you hardly wait? Boy, I knew you'd be excited about that. This is the Public Opinion, Foreign Policy, and the Historian Lecture featuring Harold Isaacs, Center for International Studies, MIT, Sources for Images of Foreign Countries. Discussant would be Melvin Small of the Department of History of WSU. This promises to be a very soulful program. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they have what you call your classical matinee, which is featuring these thrilling compositions. Al Benoni, Concerto for Violin and String Orchestra in D. That's a hot one. They're going so far as to play a piece of music by Aaron Copland, his piano quartet with the New York Quartet. They're playing all kinds of thrilling things for you. It's too bad you're too busy to listen to that kind of stuff. And what else we got here? Oh, I know what they ought to do right now. They ought to play Who Are the Brain Police from the Mothers of Invention album, Freak Out, because I've just found a picture in this magazine. It's got, Hey, you guys really ought to get this booklet. There's a picture in the toward the back of the book. They put them in the back of the book of two people, and they're naked. It shows a very twisted tree, and both the people that are standing here with no clothes on are pretty twisted, too. the man is uncircumcised, shows his actual pee-pee hanging out. They've gone quite a ways with this illustration. I don't know why they would include it in the program guide. And the woman has a very protruding navel. Obviously, the artist who rendered this couple doesn't think too much of the human body. Who are the brain police?
That's really beautiful, Frank, and it makes me want to ask you a question.
That doesn't make you want to ask you a question. Expediency makes you want to ask a question, because you know we have to be out of here by 1:30, yes, don't you?
Yeah, you caught me again.
Ah.
People have been writing many, many letters to the radio station saying...
People don't really write letters, do
yeah,
they?
Yeah, sure, they write a lot of letters to the radio station, and they say, could you please tell us just how the Mothers of Invention make their albums, because we want to know. And the reason they ask that question is because they know you're coming to a Ford Auditorium.
What an obvious,
on December 1st.
Obvious commercial hype. You sound like one of those guys that I met at the airport from the BFD company.
It's a bad company, but they put on good shows. So everyone's been saying, why don't you have Frank on and tell us about how they do the albums? We really want to know.
All right, I'll tell you how we do the albums. First of all, when my schedule permits, I'll sit down and I will write out the songs that go in the albums. Someday I'll... I know that I have a certain amount of material to turn out for a certain album. Like in one day, I'll sit down and write 7 songs. and the rest of them, I just write them when they happen to occur to me. A lot of the material that we record dates back 4 or 5 years, things that I wrote a long time ago that have already been recorded before at my studio in Cucamonga. For instance, Any Way the Wind Blows, and a song that's going to be on our third album called Take Your Clothes Off When You Dance, were both recorded a long time ago and taken and shopped around the record companies in Los Angeles about 4 years ago, and nobody was very interested in the material at that time, even though the masters were of high quality. Oh, I suppose that's just another indication that we have no future in show business. Now, some of the technical problems involved in getting our throbbing teen sound onto the grooves, you have to understand the problems involved in recording itself. There is a definite difference between what music sounds like when played live, when recorded on tape, and when recorded on disc, and each medium has its own acoustical problems. Tape and disc have different tolerances as to how much volume level can be put on. In live performance, your volume level is determined basically by the wattage of your amplifier and how long it takes before your ears start bleeding once you turn the amplifiers up. Some of what we do is very loud in live performance, and it's difficult to make it sound right when you put it on a tape, because as soon as you start recording it, the needle goes over into the red and just lays there, sort of whimpering. And when you try and transfer that tape to disc, you have more problems because they have to chop the top off, the high frequencies, and they cut all the low frequencies off and leave the middle of what's left. And sometimes I'm very disappointed when I listen to what we play, when I hear it on records, because it doesn't sound like what we play. But I suppose that's what you have to put up with. Let's take, for instance, a song like America Drinks and Goes Home from our second album, Absolutely Free. I suppose that, I'm looking at the guy in the control room, and he's sticking his finger in the air and smiling and doing all kinds of bizarre numbers in there, which would indicate that he is probably, maybe even possibly, maybe he's considered that it might be a good time to play that tune so that we can discuss it. Well, he can't do it because I'm holding the record. Oh.
This is a special request. I hope you enjoy it.
I try to find how my heart could be so blinded. How could I be through just like the rest?
Yeah.
Now I'll tell you what's in that tune. First of all, the chord changes are a satire on the typical set of chord changes used for all songs of that type from the beginning of time up to now. I don't know whether or not you can really imagine a parody of a set of chord changes, but that's what's in it.
The Backstage Special. He came out of the West in 1964, leading a band of cosmic weirdos in a frontal assault on the musical sensibilities of the civilized world. And when the smoke had cleared, the battlefield was strewn with over 20 albums, and victory was his. The enemy had been Frank Zappa.
When we first started off, the whole concept of rock and roll, the way the American public understood it, was oriented towards pretty boys strumming nice chords on guitars, singing in a high voice, and prancing a little bit, and doing lyrics about boy-girl situations that really mattered and hurt your heart. So here I was, not too attractive, with some other people equally unattractive, wishing to make a career in the rock and roll industry. Well, what could be more absurd than us going out prancing a little bit and singing those same kind of songs? Well, that just obviously wouldn't get it. However, there was a market out there somewhere for people who liked monsters and ugliness. And those were our first fans, you know.
In 64, Frank Zappa joined a band called the Soul Giants. Shortly thereafter, he gained control and renamed them the Mothers. From the start, these boys were different, both in the way they played and in the way they looked.
If you don't look the way people want you to look, then you have a problem being the way people want you to be, you see. And everybody wants you to be something. I mean, that applies to all fields besides entertainment. You know, if you're a busboy, you better look like a busboy. You can't come in there looking like a playboy if you're a busboy. And if you're a playboy, you can't look like a busboy, because then the rest of the people on the jet won't like you. You know, so everybody has a certain amount of packaging inflicted upon him based on the type of enterprise he's engaged in. See, that's just one of the facts of sociology. That's the way it works. I think that just about everybody has some sort of creative streak in them and can find some medium by which to express themselves. What makes the difference between what a performer does and what a private individual does is one guy decided he was going to go public, and he was going to he had to take that drastic step one day and start inflicting his art on other people. And at the point where you inflict it for the first time, you get some sort of feedback as to whether or not there is a sympathetic vibe for what you do somewhere out there in the universe. And if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, why don't you keep doing that, and you keep doing it, well, then you're liable to go public, and the next thing you know, you'll be a performer. Or if somebody looks at you and says, gosh, what you do is the pits, why don't you stop? Then, if somebody says that to you and you keep on doing it, you're liable to become even better. That's what I did.
Dirty Love from Overnight Sensation. Cosmic Debris from Apostrophe, Frank Zappa's only top 10 record. And from Hot Rats, Peaches and Regalia.
The Special with Jimmy Roach will return after this message.
Back in 63, if you played in a band and wanted to get them recorded, all you had to do was go to Cucamonga, California, the home of Studio Z. Upon arrival, you plunk down $13.50 for the first hour, and the proprietor, Frank Zappa, would start rolling the tapes. Since then, Frank has done such diverse things as conduct the L.A. Symphony Orchestra, produce a movie, spend 9 months in a wheelchair after being pushed off stage, and host Saturday Night Live. But through it all, he's remained clear about his true musical purpose.
I was filling in blanks left by other people who were functioning in the media. I thought that I provided a useful alternative to the love song syndrome. Filled in a lot of blanks in that mysterious area somewhere between the love song and the march. And so that's basically the realm that I function in, you know, and I try and cover that pretty completely. That's my beat. This whole business is a process of decorating time. See, I decorate time for other people, and in the process, I decorate time for my own amusement. So I just go around decorating pieces of time with physical activity, notes, agitated air, and things like that.
My guitar wants to kill your mama. Mm-hmm. From Weasel's Ripped My Flesh. And a couple of tunes from Apostrophe. Frank Zappa.
Jimmy Roach will be back with the special right after this.
The various incarnations of Frank Zappa and the Mothers have involved over 100 musicians, among them Howard Kalin and Mark Volman, former members of the Turtles. For each of them, there was a long period of adjustment as they came to understand the complexities of Frank's music.
I think it's different for every group. If you're talking specifically about the Mothers, I would say that no matter who I put into the group, it takes at least a year before they find out what they're doing there. Because what we're doing is so different from any kind of musical experience that the members might have had working with any other kind of group. No matter how professional they are, no matter how much touring they've done, what style music they've been playing before, once they come into this group, it's a completely different world. And they don't find out about it until they've been doing it for about a year. And then all of a sudden, it just snaps, you know, like with that group with Mark and Howard, it snapped at a concert in Beloit, Wisconsin, in a gymnasium, just right in the middle of the show. It seemed like the guys finally realized what I was trying to get them to do out there on stage, and from then on, it was a different world. When I'm sitting in this room writing music, I'm a very boring person. I don't think there's anybody in my audience would want to spend more than 2 minutes while I'm sitting in here doing what I'm doing and being what I am when I'm not on stage. I think that my existence other than on the stage has little or no relevance to the American public or anybody else at large. You know, they don't need to know who I am or what I do. They don't want to know. It's of no use to them. If I'm on stage and I'm jumping around and I'm a lunatic and I'm playing the guitar and doing all that stuff, then it's useful to those people because they come there to see me do that kind of stuff. And when I'm out there doing it, that's me. I am that Frank Zappa that's on the stage. There's no fake about it. I'm really that crazy, you know, but only when I'm on the stage. And if somebody has to do an interview with me, if they interview me at a show, at a time when I am crazy, then that's the person that I am. But here you are. You came to my room. I've been sitting here writing music since 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm a bum.
But it's Montana. From Overnight Sensation and Happy Together, recorded live at the Fillmore East in June of 1971.
The special with Jimmy Roach will return shortly.
The first 5 Zappa albums were released on MGM Records and have become collector's items. It was also MGM that began calling Frank's band the Mothers of Invention because they were scared of having a group called simply the Mothers. Those first efforts were tremendously intricate, involved albums, full of songs whose sarcasm demanded the listener's full attention.
Well, there are some people who are struggling in the area of worrying about their body smells and all those other terrible things that the Madison Avenue psychologists are trying to warp you with, you know. My view of it is that if it'll make you laugh, it's good for you. Or if it'll make you horny, it's good for you. Or anybody who does not commit suicide is an optimist.
And not all of Frank's music is experimental. Some of his best material has consisted of authentic recreations of the music of the late 50s. When the Mothers released the album Cruisin' with Reuben and the Jets, a lot of folks thought that it was a legitimate oldies band, not realizing that in reality, Reuben was the notorious Zappa.
Well, that's happened a lot of times with us, you know. Some of our work has been so extremely subtle as to have been mistaken for the real thing.
Some classic Zappa. Harry, You're a Beast, and What's the Ugliest Part of Your Body? From the 1967 album We're Only in It for the Money. Stuff Up the Cracks is from Reuben and the Jets, and Motherly Love from Freak Out.
We'll be back in a moment with Jimmy Roach and the special.
Most of the music of the past 10 years has been rather predictable. Of course, there's nothing wrong with predictability, but it's always good to keep someone around in the closet who can balance that out. Someone whose music can provoke a little mental stimulation. That's the job of Frank Zappa?
Well, I think it's helped all the way around. It kept me busy, you know, kept me off the street, then took me off the street and onto the road. And for the people who are listening to the records, you know, the lonely little unusual person in the small town who didn't have anything to relate to. One day there was an album called Freak Out sitting on a shelf in a store, and by accident that lonely, misunderstood, misfit person took that album and went, wait a minute, there's another one out there someplace just like me. Crazy. Deranged. He'll help me. And so, later, when more of those albums came out, these weird people took heart.
Maybe he doesn't enforce the laws, but Frank Zappa certainly is a scrutinizer. I reached him at his home near Los Angeles around New Year's time, and since he's such a trendsetter, I began by asking him what he thought the outstanding trends of the 1970s were.
Well, let me sum up the last few years for you. In the 50s, everybody thought they were cool and crazy. In the 60s, everybody thought they were concerned and evolved. In the 70s, everybody was just merely boring. And now, as we look toward the 80s, which are almost over as we speak, the only thing left to do, if you're looking for a good time, is for everybody to get smart. Now, this is not going to happen. Let's be honest about it, folks. The last thing in the world an American wants to be accused of is being intelligent. But I think that that would be the neatest thing to happen during the 80s.
What do you think people will remember most about the 1970s?
I think that they'll remember Fleetwood Mac.
Where do you see culture headed in the 1980s?
Well, it will be what we call this the new wave segment that's happening right now.
Uh-huh.
And that will go on for a couple of years until somebody rediscovers limp dick rock again. And then it'll be back to the violins in the background and, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just cyclical.
Do you think, as a lot of people are saying, a lot of what's happening culturally is just like 1965 all over again?
No, because in 1965, it was interesting because it was the first time that it had happened.
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, folk rock was cute then. But folk rock the second time around is merely mannerisms. And since the people who bring entertainment to you here in America are very interested in what you call the bottom line, they can always bank on at least the first time around on, the second time around on a mannerism, you know?
Do you think pop music is going to change a lot, or do you think it's just going to kind of stagnate?
I think that the people who are the vast consumers of pop music will be fed more quantities of second time around trends.
Mm-hmm. Where would you like to see it go? I mean, if you have any say in it.
Well, obviously I don't have any say in it, and for me to speculate on it would be ridiculous.
But aren't you enjoying a lot of increased popularity now? I mean, aren't people buying your records all of a sudden?
Yeah, we have a larger audience,
uh-huh.
Especially in Europe, you know, because for the first time in history we've had really big hit singles over there.
Uh-huh. And, which is that? What song is that?
Well, unbeknownst to America at large, Bobby Brown Goes Down was the sensation of the year in Scandinavia. It was number one for like 46 weeks.
Hey there, people, I'm Bobby Brown. They say I'm the cutest boy in town. My car is fast, my teeth are shiny. I tell all the girls they can kiss my hiney.
They would never release Bobby Brown Goes Down as a single in the United States, but CBS, who is our distributor outside of the United States, has in their contract the option to pull anything off of the album that they want to as a single. And they took a chance on Bobby Brown, and people went crazy over it.
Well, I guess in Scandinavia they're so much freer there anyway.
Well, I don't know about that, but, you know, that record was very successful, and Joe's Garage was a big single over there, and all three of the albums that we've had out on Zappa Records so far have been either top 10 or number one in that part of the world, you know, so the audience is really growing, and we've been touring over there since 1967, but this is the first time that anything like that has ever happened. And the funny thing is that it wasn't because of airplay, it was because of disco play.
It's played at the discos in Scandinavia.
Can you imagine going to a disco and dancing to Bobby Brown Goes Down? I can't.
But now it shoots too quick. Oh God, I am the American dream. But now I smell like Vaseline, and I'm a miserable son of a bitch. Am I a boy or a lady? I don't know. Wonder,
but they did.
Oh, I love to dance to your music anyway. Me and my girlfriend always do.
Yeah? Oh boy, I'd like to get some cassettes of that.
Well, okay, let's put you in a fantasy position, alright? Let's say that you could do anything you wanted to, that you had, like, power over the media. You could put whatever you wanted to over the air. And you could influence things. What would you like to see happen?
Well, the first thing I'd like to see happen, and this would probably be the biggest single breakthrough in terms of civilizing the United States of America, is to stop worrying about four-letter words, or five-letter words, or seven-letter words, or anything like that. If we could get over the primitive belief that there were certain words in the English language that had the power to corrupt you the minute that you heard them, if we could get rid of that, a lot of things would improve. First thing that would improve is the whole attitude towards what people refer to as smut. Mm-hmm. Because as long as the government can manufacture the concept of smut and hang it over the community's head like this terrible plague, as long as they can keep that going, they can keep having these bogus knights in shining armor who are going to come in and tell you they're going to clean up your community, you know? And that is a trick that has been used for years. I'd like to see that done away with. And as soon as people can say what's on their mind in the most direct way possible, we'll be able to do away with a lot of hypocrisy.
Zappa's doing everything he can do to speak his mind, and even if you don't agree with everything he says, it is impossible to deny that he's a master musical craftsman and satirist. Frank just ripped out the old sound system of the old Victoria Theater in New York and installed one of his own, along with his new movie, Baby Snakes. The film has had distribution problems, along with hostile or indifferent press reception, as does much of what Zappa has tried to put out visually. But folks, if you can, go see this movie. It's one of the most powerful and astonishing bits of cinema these eyes have seen, thanks in part to the animation skills of Bruce Pickford, and is one heck of a rock and roll movie. No tours are set for Boston as yet, but with luck, we should be seeing the movie, if not the musician, by springtime. Till next time, this is Bill Cates for the Boston Sunday Review.
One more thing, also on this show today, this is a very big show, you have to admit, we're going to have Frank Zappa, who is one of the most innovative and prolific, most interesting musicians, nastiest, most irreverent,
disgusting.
He's terrific. And yes, all of those things, and he's going to be here to talk to us. We'll take a break and we'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. With Jodie Foster, she is
Sunday
a marvelous
out here, L'Oseille Francais de Los Angeles, a French bilingual school, we've learned a lot about it. We now have the great pleasure of introducing you to Frank Zappa, one of the most innovative, prolific, interesting musicians in the world right now. This is what they say about him, one of the nastiest, one of the most irreverent, a man who just gave me one of the best back rubs I've ever had in my life. Welcome, Frank. How are you?
Hi there, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You got a haircut.
That's right.
27 albums.
Yeah.
This man has put out 27 albums. This one, Shake Your Booty, that everybody knows and loves. Joe's Garage is the new one, right? It's a rock opera.
Yeah, it was Joe's Garage.
Tell me about it.
It was originally put together to be a 3-record set, and this is the... I had to split it into 2 parts because of the economic conditions in our country. This is the first part, and then there's another part that's got 2 records in it.
Now, what do you mean, because of the economic conditions in our country?
Well, let's just talk about fiscal responsibility for a while. You know, our government isn't exactly crawling with fiscal responsibility and makes things rough. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you've got a single coming out that's called I Don't Want to Get Drafted, right?
That's right.
This is another statement. How do you feel about what's going on?
Well, the way I feel is that military strength is very important to our country, but I don't think that the technique of using the draft as an issue during an election year to make certain candidates look good is a very nice thing to do to a certain part of our population, because let's face it, if there's going to be a war, it's going to be a push-button war with things that blow up really big or gas that kills you right away, and just sticking people into uniforms and making them act in a unfortunate way, I don't think that's the way to do it, you know?
If you, Frank Zappa, were running things, were running this country, do you have any answers?
Certainly.
Tell us.
Not here.
Really?
That's right.
Well, you mentioned fiscal responsibility. Do you think there's any way that we can get the country off this inflationary spiral?
Well, I never thought it would come to this, but, you know, I saw George Putnam on television last night, and he was talking about all these kind of things, and I've always felt that George was a very conservative kind of a person, and you know what? He was saying some stuff last night that I thought was really smart. He doesn't always say things that I think are smart, but
well,
when I find myself agreeing with George Putnam, I begin to wonder.
As a matter of fact, I've read a lot about you, as everybody has. You've been in the music business for a long, long time. This man started the Mothers of Invention back in the mid-60s, and from there it was history. And the things that are written about you are, he comes off like a wild man. He used to have the hair down to here, you know. But as a matter of fact, deep down underneath all that, he's a rather conservative fellow. Would you agree with that?
I'm probably even more conservative now than I was a couple of minutes ago.
the more the country gets into the shape it's in. You're a local boy. You were born in Baltimore, but you brought up in San Diego and Lancaster, up in the high desert country, Southern California. What kind of a kid were you back in high school?
I was naughty.
That's what I hear. Got thrown out of school all the time.
Yeah, that's true. They were very happy to be rid of me, and I was happy to be rid of them.
But you really loved music from the time you were...
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I didn't like school, because I always felt that what I was being trained to do in school was to grow up to be a consumer and not have any... have a chance to do anything that would improve the quality of my life or to participate in anything that was beautiful or interesting. It was really drudgery.
So here you are, and a lot of... You've got yourself in a lot of trouble with your music along the way, too.
Well, that's not exactly true.
Well, the Jewish princess made a lot of people mad. The Anti-Defamation League were going to take you into court. Then you fixed everything by doing Catholic girls.
This is also not true. There was never any question of the Anti-Defamation League taking me to court.
Uh-huh.
As the Anti-Defamation League used the song Jewish Princess to obtain a certain amount of public relations value for their organization. There was no lawsuit. I mean, there was never even anything in the paper that said lawsuit. And that's just people misreading what was actually printed in newspapers.
But people do get very sober-sided, don't they? I mean, you've got a terrific sense of humor. You use it. You use it in your lyrics. You use it in your music. You offend some people.
Does that bother you? No, it doesn't bother me. The only thing I feel about that is I feel sorry for people who can't laugh at things. Because once you stop laughing, then you're really in a lot of trouble. And if you want to go back to the Jewish princess business for a moment, let's just say that if there weren't Jewish princesses, they would have a point. But unfortunately, they exist, or fortunately, depending on your viewpoint. All I did was state the fact that they're out there, and the song says, I want one.
So you were saying fortunately they exist because you kind of like them, right?
So, you know, why should they be getting on my case?
But you are. I think this is something that everybody in the business knows, in the music business, you are a very serious composer and very well respected by your peers. You care about music a lot, don't you?
Well, of course.
Did you study it?
Yeah.
Where?
In the library and by listening to records.
You've got a movie coming out, too.
In June. Yeah.
Yeah, you produced it, you're starring in it, you wrote it.
Yeah, yeah, all that stuff.
All of that. Tell us about that.
It's called Baby Snakes, and it'll be coming out in June. It's about people who do stuff that's not normal.
People like you.
Well, I'm one of the people in the movie that's doing not normal stuff. There are other people.
Do you like the movie?
Yes, and you'll like the movie, too. I know you will.
Really?
Yeah, I know. You look like the kind of a person that really needs to see that movie. I'm telling you, Kelly, when I was rubbing your neck and I found out how stiff you actually were, I said to myself, here is a woman that needs to see Baby Snakes. This girl craves Baby Snakes.
I'll be there. I'll be there. I'll be first in line. Yes, I did. I said, I was getting
How's your headache?
It's fine.
It's getting worse, isn't it?
Ask me some more questions. No, it helped.
Did it help?
You have four kids.
That's right.
Yeah, tell their names.
Moon, Dweezil, Amit, and Diva.
And they are how old?
They range in age from 13 to 7 months.
And you don't think that they'll ever grow up and want to change their names to Tom and Debbie? And
I would be amazed if they did, but they always have that option. Unless, of course, the laws of our great country are changed to preclude it.
What made you give them these names?
Well,
why not, right?
You know, when you release an album, you have the problem of what are you going to call it? And when you have a child, you have the same problem. And you try and get the name to go with the event.
And Moon was?
Moon was, that was her name. That's what she should have been called.
Was it close to the moon landing? Or?
No.
You are a good family man.
You betcha.
You've lived in the same neighborhood for a lot. I mean, people get the idea that you're, you know, scattered. And as a matter of fact, here you are. You show up with a suit and tie and got your hair cut, all cleaned up. And
Kelly, I can't help it. I'm really a nice person. I'm a groovy guy. I'm also conservative. And how's your headache, Kelly?
It's just fine. What else you got in the hopper besides the movie?
We're getting ready to do a tour. And we will actually be playing in Los Angeles on Easter Sunday. At the sports arena. I think it's sold out, so too bad. But
oh, I'm sorry. I'll
we could get you in there if
listen.
You want another headache.
You like Los Angeles?
I don't like Los Angeles. I think that it's really sad here.
Why do you live here?
Well, when I first came here, I thought that it was a nice place because there was a lot of activity, and musical activity and artistic activity. Mm-hmm. That was in the early 60s. But there came a time when the people who were doing a lot of these things started getting harassed by the police, and the policies of the city government and the policies of the police department in Los Angeles drove a lot of what you could consider the artistic element out of town. Around 1965 or 66, it was impossible to find a place to work if you're a rock and roll musician and you want to play in Hollywood because the clubs were being squeezed out of business. And so we moved away. And
you're back.
Well, I came back because after moving to New York and working there for a while, and also having a child, it's very difficult for my imagination to think of raising a kid in New York.
Right, if L.A. is bad, New York is worse. Frank Zappa, musician extraordinaire, back rubber, may I say. Thanks for coming down and spending some time with us.
Bye.
We'll be right back with Donald Sutherland and his family. Frank Zappa joins us this morning, an author. The title of the book, The Real Frank Zappa Book by Frank Zappa. You know, can I make an observation that I was kind of toying with, and I didn't know how to put it, but it strikes me that you're aging well.
Why, thank you.
Yeah. You seem to be living a life that has many factors, though perhaps least of which is the fact that you used to be Frank Zappa of the Mothers of Invention.
Well, that seems to be a fact, yes.
Yeah, well, you can't help that, huh?
Yeah.
So, here you are, you've written a book. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing I'm struggling with is a question that sounds offensive, but do your fans read books?
No.
See, if I hadn't known your answer was going to be that, I might have hesitated to ask a question. So why did you write the book?
Well, because I thought it might be fun to do, but I was wondering while I was writing it, who does read books, whether it's my fans or anybody's fans?
You also have to have somebody to put something to put in the pages. You have to have, shall we say, a
story
message.
Well, yeah, there's stuff in there. I think there's there's some stuff in there.
I guess if you could sum it up, you wouldn't have bothered to put it in book form. But you are in real life now, a social activist,
commentator, yes.
A commentator, yeah. A businessman,
for sure,
a parent,
absolutely.
Let's talk about the commentator part. Mm-hmm. What? How do you see yourself as a social commentator?
Because I have an opinion about whatever happens to pop up, and I'm not shy about expressing it. Somebody asks me a question, I'll say what I think.
You furthermore are on the bandwagon, shall we say. You registered 11,000 young people to vote?
Yeah. Seemed like a waste of time, didn't it? I tried.
Why was it so important to you that they voted?
Well, I think that it's important for people to wake up to the fact that in the United States, politics has turned into something not nice. And you need to introduce to the political process new people who might take it seriously.
Okay, so that on one hand strikes me as a little bit cynical, but on the other hand, a cynic doesn't necessarily believe in the process, which you must believe in, otherwise why would you encourage people to participate?
Well, there's not too many choices, so you have to consider the alternative. You either believe that politics could be fixed and you could use the machinery of politics to bring about a constructive change or constructive anything.
To the degree that you will be remembered, and you probably will more than most, you will be remembered as Frank Zappa of the Mothers of Invention.
Yeah, the guy who had the picture taken sitting on the toilet.
Yes. Did you elevate the culture?
No.
Did you debase the culture?
No. I didn't have much involvement with the culture because I was never allowed access to a major portion of the culture.
You are, as I said before, a businessman. If I was looking to do business with the Soviet Union, I'll admit, Frank Zappa is not the first guy I'd think to call.
Well, you'd be making a mistake.
How do you know so much?
I could definitely help you out.
How so?
Because I was introduced to a bunch of very interesting people over there who know an even more interesting batch of people over there, and they all want to do business with the West. And they've asked me to help them achieve certain things. And then there are people in the United States who want to do business in the Soviet Union, and they've asked me, could I help them out, introduce them, or help their project?
You were also a parent, and by today's standards, you must have done okay in that your kids are not on drugs
not
and
in
not
jail.
In jail.
That's right. Not on drugs, not in jail. I did all right.
Can you claim credit for that, or were you just lucky, maybe?
No, 50%, because I think that maybe less, because my wife certainly had a large role in making the kids turn out good.
You'll acknowledge that people might find that surprising. I mean, we saw you standing on stage playing your guitar, and it's not your classic American example of father knows best.
Let me point something out to you. So, I just came from a place called Spain. In this wonderful country, if you play a guitar, this is a good thing. People respect you because you play a guitar. In the United States, if you play a guitar, you are treated as if you're a public enemy, as I've just been
treated.
Wait
a minute. On the other hand, thousands of people will line up to buy tickets to hear you play the guitar.
Yeah, but other people in media would go, well, he plays a guitar. How could he could be a good father? He's playing guitar.
Yeah. Well, here you are.
Yeah. Here I am. I guess I'm going to be going pretty soon, too. Here you are, and there you go.
Well, we don't actually put it this way. We normally say thank you very much, and we'll be back after a message. But bye.
Just say here you are. Bye-bye.
We will be back after this.